Good evening. Thank you very much for coming to this midweek service, although it's a bit of a different kind of service because it's a class. In fact, it could be a lecture if you want me to make it one. It's good to be back with you guys again. Thank you for, well, the last few times I've been here. It's been great. You're all spread out. I was going to stand on the floor. That's when I thought you all sit in the first 10 rows, but you're all spread out, so I have to be up on the stage. And there it goes. So you've got the title, The Postmodern Wave, and postmodernism is a topic I've been asked to speak on many times in the last 12 years at different universities, different churches. What is postmodernism? Well, to answer that, we'll have to figure out what modernism is, but not quite yet. We're going in our time tonight, and I'm looking for the wall clock. Where's the clock on the wall? Because I gave my phone to somebody. Okay. All right, I'm just going to assume everything's okay as long as you guys are paying attention, because I don't see any time. We're going to be looking at four aspects of postmodernism and five strategies what to do about it. And I think that that's going to really work out. John Yang, thank you for the invitation, or at least for approaching me initially. I know the invitation was okayed by the people who would have vetoed it otherwise, but thank you for reaching out to me. I'd love to speak in the greater Atlanta area. Postmodernism is a philosophy. Well, that's what it's normally called. But it's more than just a philosophy. It's a movement. Because a philosophy would be something that is well thought through. And this isn't really so well thought through. But it's also a methodology. It's a way of looking at reality. Now, how many of you have heard the word postmodern or postmodernism? Okay, so can you go ahead and define it for me? It's one of those things that, could you open that for me? It's a recipe for disaster. You give a speaker holding a microphone and a clicker an unopened bottle, you're going to get water somewhere. Thank you so much. You'll be able, at the end of this talk, you'll be able to explain to a friend what it is. And when you tell them, last night I was at church and it was a philosophy talk. It was postmodernism. What's that? And you can say, well, here are five aspects of it. Doesn't that sound familiar? They'll say, yes, not only are you a brilliant student and we're paying attention, but that makes sense. Because this is not rocket science, what we're doing tonight. Others would say, it's none of the above. It's just a mood. It's a mood that the academic world is in. I'm calling it a wave, okay? Philosophy, movement, methodology, movement, wave. Ideas are powerful. And you'd say, yeah, but I've never really understood, I've never heard of postmodernism, that it hasn't affected me. Well, who cares whether you heard it or not? I was in the Congo a few months ago. Now the Ebola is breaking out again. It's kind of crazy. Some poor villager has never heard of Ebola. Does that like confer immunity? Just because you've never heard of it? I mean, what is that? There are all kinds of nasty things in our world, even inside our bodies, we may never have heard of, but they're there. And it's in the air that we breathe. Be as though this auditorium, they drop the oxygen level down a bit, and they raise the carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide level. I mean, it would affect everybody. It's in the air you breathe. Just a little bit of a change. It affects us all, understood or not. And postmodernism, as we'll see, is a curious blend of relativism when, well, your truth is just your truth, but it's not really true for me and the rest of the world, with the opposite of that, which is making some very strong claims about the truth itself. Powerful ideas. Truth, relativism, absolutism, is the dominant philosophy of our age, as John mentioned, in universities. I speak in usually 5 universities a year, maybe 10. But even when I was in college, from the 70s on, postmodernism was building tremendous headway. When I was in college in the 80s, it was entrenched. It's actually been here for decades. It's a dominant philosophy also in government, particularly the judiciary, but I'd say also Congress. It's the certainly dominant philosophy in art and in seminaries even. And I've taken classes at many seminaries. This is what they think. Well, what is it? Well, first, it's a reaction to something. Okay, it's a reaction to modernism. What's modernism? What is that? Well, modernism is a 19th century viewpoint. In modernism, everything's getting better. There's tremendous optimism. It's like through mathematics or physics, we'll be able to figure out, through science, through technology, we'll be able to figure out how to live 200 years old without any sicknesses. Actually, I was reading an article this week in a news magazine I respect, but I couldn't believe what they were saying. They said in Japan, more than one half of kids born today can expect to live 100 years. Now, in America, the lifespan's going the other way for other reasons. But it is stunning what technology and science have accomplished. And I don't want to put that down. But over-optimism, where science becomes the savior, that's not good. Maybe one day the machines will rise up. I mean, this has been a theme in science fiction for more than 100 years now. Oh, I thought it just came out in the 90s. No. Yeah, like the 1890s, actually even earlier, because that's what technology does. Something's changing. Our world is an amazing world. But if we put our hope in technology, then we're going to be disappointed. So in the 19th century, we have all of these things going on, and people are feeling better and better, all kinds of idealistic political programs like Marxism, for example. And the attitude is that really we've discovered nearly everything there is to learn. One of the most famous physicists of 100 years ago, more than 100 years, he said, well, I think there's really not much left, if anything, for science to discover. I mean, that was a confident, pronouncement back then, all under the banner of progress. And then along came Einstein, who realized the world's not what it seems to be. There's space-time, there's gravity, space itself can be bent. And not only did he teach these amazing things, they were proven experimentally. We realized that matter is made up of little things called atoms, and then we found out, well, those are made up of something else, which are actually made up of something else too. We thought light was a particle, a photon, or we thought it was a wave. We find out it's really neither, and it's both. And if you say that you totally understand modern science, especially quantum science, that's clear evidence that you don't. Because even the experts would say, anyone who says he understands modern physics clearly doesn't. So you have this tremendous optimism. And then at the very end of the 19th century, the very beginning of the 20th, you have these wars. Oh, they're nasty wars. They're wars in South Africa. They're wars in the Balkans. There's a war between Russia and Japan. Then you've got World War I. And this was considered that it would be the war that would end all wars, right? But not so. And then you have World War II, and actually other wars in between, like the Spanish Civil War, lots of them. Then we've got the horrors that come along with certain regimes, because ideas are powerful, and when a madman puts his ideas into effect, when he has the force of guns behind him, that's a dangerous thing. And whatever people thought about the goodness, the sweetness of the human heart was certainly overthrown just in the first half of the 20th century, the century when most of you were born. And we had World War II. And didn't stop there, because wars just keep on going. It's wars, it's putting our hope in politics and programs. We want to take control instead of honoring God. And the result of this is horrific. Genocides, numerous genocides. And I know, because I've been to a lot of the genocide sites around the world. Most recently, Rwanda, but others as well. Here's a famous photo from the Vietnam War. Often I get criticized because I engage a lot with atheists. And atheists will sometimes say, religion has caused a lot of people pain, suffering, and their lives. I said, well, you're right. Horrible things have been done in the name of religion. I'm not sure that religion causes wars. I think wars are going to happen anyway. But if you can dress it up in religious clothes, it seems more legitimate at the time. But the truth is, those who've taken their ideology, their atheistic ideology, and have forced it on the world are responsible for far more deaths than ever the total was in religious wars. And this is just account for the 20th century, not even counting the first 18, 19 years of this century. About 40 million killed in war directly, close to 200 million killed in state-sponsored violence. Whether this is people being sent off to a gulag or being starved to death or genocide, whatever. So everyone's guilty. Religious people, unreligious people, irreligious people, and it just doesn't stop. And if all I did was show you pictures like this tonight, you go away home very heavy-hearted indeed. I was just in Israel a few weeks ago. You know, they built a wall around the Palestinians. So that this next picture, you might not have got that, but it's kind of a Christmas picture. Can you see it? Because Bethlehem is actually on the other side of the wall. That's in the West Bank, separated from Israel proper. And then no wonder people want to escape in drugs, in music, and going totally crazy, especially the youth. And they've been doing that since the 1950s. Maybe they did it in the 40s, but I think it was tamer then. But in the 50s, it got crazy. In the 60s, it was crazy plus all the drugs added in. I don't even want to think about the 70s and beyond. So much for medicine and technology, and the world's constantly getting better, and everything's going to be keeny, peachy. Family's been rewritten. We have all this food and all these gadgets in the world, plenty of food on the planet to feed everybody. But corrupt people, normal people with power, corrupt people get in the way, and so we have hundreds of millions of people living in abject poverty, even though all the resources are there. And some of them may criticize this country. They may actually hate this country, but they still want their kids to go to school here. It's interesting. It's always worse somewhere else. And then those we would trust as men of God, those who would look to for guidance and integrity, often have let us down. And huge issues like the resurgence of slavery right now. 5 to 10 million, is it more than that? But millions of people are slaves today. I thought they dealt with that in the 19th century. Well, kind of. You want to buy a wife? And so, again, this could be very depressing indeed. When I was a kid, I thought for sure there's going to be World War III. There has to be a sequel to World War II. It can't just be 1-2, it's got to be 1-2-3. And in my heart, I kind of hoped it would happen because I'd seen all these war movies. But back then, when I was a kid, war movies, you never showed blood. People just said, "Ooh, you got me," and they fell over. There was never blood. There were never severed limbs. This is horrific, the degree of goriness that we become used to. So this is what I mean when I say it's a reaction. Modernism promised the world, like, it's going to be great, the end of war, everyone's going to be happy, and we're going to be a brotherhood of man. And how did the 20th century turn out? I mean, shattered hopes, disillusionment. And I think that reaction led to suspicion of authority. The authorities were wrong before. Why should we trust them? Why should we trust the police, teachers, textbooks, male leadership, Wall Street, the educational system, historical records, organized religion, and especially religious texts? These are the most to be doubted texts of all, because they have religion as a motive, and we know that they are a tool to oppress others. So there's this suspicion. So what's the big deal? Well, postmodern thinking, which in a sense is a rejection of truth, it's already affected your church's youth group. It's already affected your workplace. It's everywhere, absolutely everywhere. Suspicion, it's more than just suspicion. So 4 facets, 5 strategies, let's jump in. The first facet, In postmodernism, there's no truth. There are truths. What's the difference between truth and truths? Darius, I think you know. It's that letter S. I mean, I was amazed. I was talking to an elder. I don't want to embarrass him or say which church he was in, but it's one of ours. And it was a kind of a counseling situation, not in Georgia. And he was talking about how, you know, people have their own truth, and they have to understand what their truth is. Now, wait a minute. If you mean people have different perspectives on the world, sure. But when you start saying different truths, what, there can be like multiple truths? Like right now, this guy's talking about postmodernism, and at the same time, he's dunking a basketball on that invisible... No, this ends up in nonsense. I want you to really think about this. Is there truth or truths? Postmodernism says there are many truths. When I did my master's at Harvard, one of the main things that they were trying to teach was that Christianity originally had no set form. It was all kinds of doctrines and denominations. And then historically, the Catholic Church persecuted all the little groups, and they claimed that they were the one true church and had always been so. But wait a minute. When I read the New Testament, in fact, when I read church history, I see unity gradually splintering. I don't see multiple groups all believing their own thing. Some of them worshiped a mother goddess. So a form of Christianity that worships a mother goddess in the second century, how come we never read about that in the first century? How come that's not in the Bible? There's this desire to take all these strange groups and act like it's a democracy of ideas, that there were many Christianities originally, not one. I don't think that's true. Have you ever heard this before? Trying to have a talk with somebody? I used to do that as a college student. People would say it sometimes at Duke, well, that's just your interpretation. I thought what they meant was my reasoning was faulty, and I'm saying, well, show me where I'm wrong. But I think they actually meant it often more in a postmodern sense. That's your interpretation. That's your truth. This is my truth. The world's big enough we can have umpteen interpretations, right? Ever seen this image? Typically on a bumper sticker, but other places too. Now, the basic message is great. We should coexist. There should be freedom of religion for all. But the implication is that what? Who's to say? They're all equal. They're all equal. Okay. I don't know what subject you were good at in school. Maybe you weren't very good at math, but you loved to write. Maybe you were a big reader, but not so strong in science. Well, if we don't want to make the students feel bad, we could say we're all equally good at math. And on the average, that's true, isn't it? We are all exactly equal on average. But to pretend that one person who finishes the test in 5 minutes is the same as the person who takes the full hour and still gets half of them wrong, that's nonsense. It's a lovely idea to make everyone equal, but we're not equal. A common image, this is a picture of Everest. Isn't that cool? The common image is that all religions are just different paths up the mountain. As long as you get to the top, right? And we will get to the top, then there you go. The truth is, some mountains, there's not more than one or two ways up, and even then you've got a good chance of dying. I mean, what kind of mountaineer worth his or her salt would say, oh yeah, you can go up any way you want? No, I don't think so. I don't think it works that way. Truth usually limits our options. We're told to read between the lines what's not being said, not just what is being said. That's called intertextuality. You'll hear this: winners write the history books. And that is certainly true. They do, and history books do have an agenda. None is totally objective. But hopefully, if you read multiple books, you'll be able to kind of figure out what's going on. Winners write the history books this way. U.S. history is not presented typically from the viewpoint of the people who were here before the Europeans came. That's not normally the way the history is presented. Or from the viewpoint of women or the African slaves. I thought of an example. The Canaanites didn't write the book of Joshua. Can you imagine if they did? Here we were, minding our own business, which is not really true, the stuff those guys were doing. But they didn't write the book of Joshua. If they had, what kind of perspective would it have given? So in a way, it kind of makes sense at first. But imagine if the Acts of the Apostles was recounted by the high priest. Imagine if Caiaphas had written it about this guy Jesus, the one he had crucified. Yes, it would be a different story. So there is something to this. One's perspective, one's power, one's position does affect claims that are made and enshrined, especially in sacred texts. Postmodernism actually can teach us to be more careful thinkers. Cultural diversity is not a bad thing. Tolerance is a good thing. But what is tolerance? Tolerance is, I think you're wrong, but you're my next door neighbor and we're going to continue to be friends. My next door neighbor took me out to breakfast yesterday. He's always trying to convert me to his religion. The harder he tries, and I'm trying hard too, I think actually the more we like each other. And it's not because he's becoming less of one thing and I'm becoming less of another. But it's the tolerance in the way it should be. Tolerance actually requires disagreement. If I say, well, you know, I tolerate you. What do you mean you tolerate me? What are your opinions on these issues? Oh, identical to mine. I tolerate you. Well, that's not tolerant. Tolerance is when there's disagreement. Tolerance requires, if there's tolerance, someone has to think the other guy's wrong. But tolerance is staying respectful and connected even despite a disagreement. So this idea that all religions are equal is kind of a crazy idea. They're so different. They're not equal. Did any of you come to the debate in October? One, couple people. So I had a debate with Sheikh Shabir Ali. This was my third debate with him. The crowd, the North River Church, which is in Marietta, probably one-third Muslims, dressing like Muslims too. It was very easy to tell who was who. And two-thirds everything else. The imams and the sheikh himself and all the Muslims, they loved it. Because they were treated warmly and respectfully by the Christians. And even by the guy who was debating the Christian side. The guy up on the stage. Now, if you're going to tell me, oh, you all got along well, so you realized you all believe the same thing, I would say you're wrong. Probably a lot of the Muslims would be pretty offended. You know, if you acted like, well, really, you did agree with what Doug was saying. Because Douglas was teaching that Jesus is the Son of God. That was the whole reason we had the debate. He's not just a prophet. I don't know where you live, where you think all religions are the same. The differences are much greater than the similarities. Did you see this movie? Incredible cinematography. I read the book when the book came out, because at that time our kids were in school, and that was one of the books they were reading. So I read it to find out. I liked the movie even more, but they both said the same thing, basically. Truth is what you make it. Because this fellow, Piscine or Pi, is shipwrecked. In the lifeboat, there's a tiger, and there are other amazing things that happen over a period of many months. And when he finally is interviewed by the police, they don't believe his story, which that's what happened. At least I think that's what happened. And then he says, well, okay, I'll change it. There was a horrible disaster. Yeah, we're in a lifeboat. We ate each other, cannibalism, and here I am today. And the fellow says, oh, but I like the first. The first one was a better story. And that's like the punchline. Right, so you choose the version of reality that you want. It doesn't matter whether it makes sense or not. You choose what's true. It's your truth. And so Life of Pi, because this guy, Piscine, he's born a Hindu. He comes to know God through Jesus, but he learns to worship in Islam. So kind of the smoothing out and making everything the same. So not truth, but truths. Multiple truths. You know, people say, rather have a strong faith and a weak faith and a strong bridge than a strong faith and a weak bridge. What do you think? I took this picture in England recently. the British, you know, in the U.S. it would probably just say, here's the weight limit and so forth. They just say weak bridge. They don't care if that hurt the bridge builder's feelings. The engineer felt offended. It's a weak bridge, okay? 17 tons maximum gross weight, okay. I don't care how much faith you have. If the bridge is weak, it doesn't even get a tiny bit stronger just because you believe it. So I would say this stuff about truth and truths, our world is very confused right now. Very confused. Our world kind of looking in the mirror narcissistically, wanting the truth to be what they want it to be. But there's only one truth. Because if you say there's more than one truth, then how can one thing and the opposite be true at the same time? I mean, this doesn't make sense. If I say, you guys are all in your home watching sports on TV. And then I say, you guys are all here in the auditorium listening to me. They're both true, right? No, they're not both true. I mean, you may be daydreaming about watching sports. I don't know. I'm not Mr. Sports. Where was I when the World Series was going on? Yeah, I was in Israel. And I just heard someone mention the World Series. I said, oh, is it World Series already? Who's in it? I didn't know. We had a meeting, a thinly attended meeting on Sunday night. And my youngest, my 25-year-old, said, it's because of the football. I said, oh, is there a big game on? She said, yeah, Alabama and Georgia. Really? Who won? Kind of from my perspective, although sports are fun, no one's going to remember in 50 or 100 years. No one will care nor remember. That's just, see, I'm making an excuse here for not being cool. So the first thing is truth, not truth. Secondly, not morals. Postmodernism does not like talking about right and wrong and virtue. It's values. Values are the ones you choose. Values are things that you value. You value that? Well, then that's your value. You reject that? Then that's not your value. So what you value is valuable to you, obviously. But what about actual right and wrong? Well, we don't really talk about that. Moral relativism is the engine that drives postmodernism. Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher, was one of the few who really understood where this goes. He said, you know, well, in a book, his madman said, God is dead and we have killed him. Nietzsche was an atheist till his death. Nietzsche understood that if there is no God, then there is no right and wrong. If there's no authority, if there's no God out there, then nothing is actually truly right or wrong. It's just stuff you approve of or disapprove of, or you find pleasant or unpleasant. But it's not really wrong. And he understands where this is going. He actually predicted the 20th century would be one of the bloodiest centuries ever, as the human race went crazy, went insane. Actually, that's what happened to Nietzsche. He went insane in his life. In his book, Beyond Good and Evil, he says, there's no such thing as morality, only moral interpretations. So someone can say this is right or wrong. Don't listen to him. There are opinions about what's right or wrong, but nothing is actually right or wrong. Everything's neutral. Nothing's right or wrong. So that's deep in postmodernism. So values are kind of like ice cream flavors. What flavor do you guess that is? I'm not totally sure. I know that's not chocolate. How about that one? If it's one of my two favorite flavors, coconut and vanilla, then I'm good. But there are a lot of other flavors I like too. So how many of you like dirt ice cream with dirt mixed into it? No? How about with licorice in it? How about Brussels sprout and kale ice cream? So when we're talking about ice cream, we'd say that's distasteful or this I like. And that's the way our world has approached values, morality. It'd be wrong for you. You'd feel too weird, so you don't do it. But for me, this is fine. There's no manual. There's no code book. There's no judgment day. There's no law that we're supposed to be obeying. Just fulfill yourself and have a good time. Dominant philosophy now for a couple generations. So truths, not truth. What was the last one? Values, not morals. You know, you hear about family values. What's the opposite of family values? Well, we don't want to offend anybody. Morals, right and wrong. Number three, tell them I'm on track, but I am going to speed up in the next section here. Number three, inclusion, not exclusion. It's bad to be excluded. Someone asked me if I'd heard of Carlton Pearson. I don't remember who asked me. It may have been someone in this room. And I looked him up, and I saw his book, God is Not a Christian, Nor a Jew, Muslim, or Hindu. God dwells in me and you, and there you go. The gospel of inclusion, reaching beyond religious fundamentalism to the true love of God and self. What a beautiful idea. I love the idea that all religions are right. I love that. I don't have to really spend any time evangelizing except the atheists. But in postmodernism, well, why do they need to be wrong? If there's a God, wouldn't he accept everybody? So I want postmodernism to be true, because then I can just live the way I want to live. But if it's not true, there are consequences. So the teaching is that marginalization is bad. Inclusion is good. Christianity is exclusive, so Christianity is bad. When I was in seminary at Drew doing my doctorate, each day a different student would lead the devotional. Very postmodern university. Not all the students were. But one of the guys did a devotional, morning devotional, on dandelions. And he was sharing about a yard overrun with dandelions, how beautiful it was, all those yellow flowers. So who are you to call it a weed? I say it's beautiful. And he was talking about values. You know, what one person finds repulsive or... No, that it's the beauty's in your eyes. Who's to say? Wow. That made me just want to go out and blow dandelion seeds everywhere. Not really. So this exclusion is shown in oppression, racism, homophobia, ageism. That's where age is a detriment instead of being an honor like it is in traditional culture. Patriarchy, classism. And I'll just highlight two of these. One, sexism. I was applying for a visa for a certain Africa. I've made a couple trips to Africa this year. And one of the visas I had to apply ahead of time, I had to give my name. I had to give my gender. There were three options. Can you guess what they were? Male, female, and prefer not to say. But when I did my doctorate, and this is more than 20 years ago, we learned that there were at least five genders, if not seven. Right, because there's straight, gay, lesbian. I mean, do we need to keep going? Right now, LGBTQ, LR, MNP. I mean, you just choose the one you want. And there's pressure to not only eliminate the distinction, but to force kids in middle school and high school, and sometimes even younger, to force them to be open that, you know, maybe you're not the gender you look like. And then there was a poll taken last year, over 50% of high school students. Well, I'm afraid it would have been the same even if they went out in the broader population. One of the questions, a science question, was, is your gender determined at birth? And over half of them said no. What do you mean it's not determined? I mean, it's XX or XY. Very, very, very rarely you may have some combination, hermaphroditism, though, but that's a very small thing. I mean, gender is determined at birth. It's determined before birth. So we talk about fake news. We've got fake science. We've got all kinds of fake stuff. And then also, of course, evangelism would be immoral because evangelism is an oppression. You're telling someone they're wrong, and you're implying that others are wrong, and you're forcing your view on others. Yet, we are to evangelize. God, our Savior, wants all people to be saved and to come to a knowledge of the truth. That doesn't just happen with them living their normal lives. God takes no pleasure in the death of anyone. It's not like God wants people to lose their way, but we manage to lose our way all by ourselves. And of course, in Luke 12, which is quite parallel to John 12, if you know your master's will and don't get ready, you're in big trouble. If you don't know and you do things deserving punishment, you're in trouble too, but not as much. From everyone who's been given much, much will be demanded. From the one who's been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. And that is fair. And God is fair. So you've got these forms of exclusion. But I would say, actually, truth is exclusive. And you could use almost any kind of analogy. Math is always very easy. Who knows the squared root of 144? 12? Is that your answer? Is that your final answer? Because you're only half right. Minus 12 and plus 12. They're two answers, right? But it doesn't leave open the option of 11 being the correct answer. Right? Remember the multiplication table? It's okay. You're not going to make me feel uncomfortable if you say you believe the multiplication table. It matches reality. Typically, there are a lot more wrong answers than there are right answers. Sometimes there's more than one right answer, but usually there are a lot more wrong answers. And Christianity is saying it's true, but I would say in that great vision of the book of Revelation, there's a vast multitude. No one can count from every tribe and tongue, right? Every people. That is God's vision of everyone making it. No kind of person, no class of person being excluded, no individual being excluded, unless that person doesn't want to know God. So Christianity, I would say, is actually inclusive, incredibly inclusive. And people are still amazed when they walk into your church and they see that you're not separating, not sitting in different sides of the auditorium based on your race. And then the fourth one, the last one, journey, not destination. In postmodernism, it's about your journey. Now, that's a very famous ship, isn't it? Where is it going? Who thinks it's going to New York? Well, unless there's another New York, a few thousand meters down, Titanic, right? That was the one they said, not even God could sink her. She's got these watertight compartments, and she's the Titans. You know who the Titans were? In Greek mythology, they were the giants. They tried to storm Mount Olympus. They tried to unseat, dethrone the gods. Very interesting title, a name for a ship to quote the Titanic. It's like, I dare you. You know, we're number one. No one can beat us. But unfortunately, they hit an iceberg. And I think you know the story way back in 1912. So even if all the rich people have gotten off the boat, and even if you get up to first class and you're helping yourself to the bar, sitting in those comfortable chairs, I don't care about the destination, it's the journey. Well, the journey is about to change, firstly. Secondly, destination does matter. Now, for Jesus, destination matters, because ultimately we're with God or we're simply not, the second death. But He wants us to have the abundant life also, but it's not necessarily a rich life. It's an abundant life. A high school valedictorian was interviewed in a newspaper. Oh, well, I'll tell the rest of that story in fellowship, I guess. So there we go. Good luck. These are the four dominant aspects, at least as I'm explaining it, of postmodernism. First, truths, not truth. Secondly, not morals. That's not right and wrong. It's not vice and virtue. It's values. Inclusion, not exclusion. Everyone makes it. Everyone makes it. Everyone gets an A on the test. And we're not going to think about the destination. Who's to say? It's the journey. Of course, a Christian would say it's both. Christianity may be exclusive in one way, but it's the most inclusive thing you'll find in the other way. Yes, we have different values if you're talking about ice cream flavors or vegetables. But when we're talking about morality, who's going to say that eating babies for fun, torturing babies for fun, is just a value? If you don't value it, that's not your cup of tea. I understand. Who would say that? Only a sociopath. And it's not truth, but truth. Now, because of the time, you're going to watch me skip all kinds of stuff. And maybe you're feeling right now, wow, you mean there's more? But see, I think most of you in this auditorium, you knew those four things I just mentioned. You already knew that because you've been hearing the lingo, and it's been around a long time. And so if I come back for a part two, I would share strategies. So this will be a little fast. Our world is not Protestant and Catholic. Our world is much more Muslim and Hindu than we might realize. And so one strategy is to intentionally interact, to intentionally spend time with people from other cultures, not just the people you feel comfortable with. One thing I love about the church, in our teaching program down in the Caribbean, for example, my friends from all continents, I love it. I mean, the church helps you there, but we still have to try to deal with residual racism the other days of the week because it's there. We need to engage, whether it's someone who's religious or not, and it's always much better to talk to the person than to talk about the person. Talk to him. And then if you misunderstood, he has a chance to defend himself. Right? We're talking about engagement. Secondly, we need to be critics of culture. Critics of culture, not just swept up in culture. Now, I like music. We went to the Atlanta Symphony a couple weeks ago. I like sports. The Simpsons, I've only seen it once, but it seemed pretty funny. But we need to be culture critics. Listen to the lyrics on the radio. Read the books and think about them. What messages are we receiving? Paul did that very, very well. And when Paul spoke to non-Jewish audiences, he never quoted the Bible because the Bible would have no authority. But he knew what they thought because he read their authors. And I challenge us to go further. Don't just hear one talk on postmodernism. Go further. We need to be critics of the church. What do you mean? I have to come late and sit in the back row with my arms crossed? No, I don't mean that kind. I mean constructive criticism. Now I don't want to see who's in the back row. So I don't want to be prejudiced against you. I'll forget what I said in a moment. But we need to be critics even of the church. And not just the church, but Christianity more broadly speaking. There's a lot of shallow religion out there, like the health and wealth stuff. The people, you know, God's plan is for you to become rich. And those crooked preachers, and they're always crooked preachers, when they say, give money to the church and you could become rich like me, they're criminal. Maybe not technically criminal because they haven't been caught yet. But these guys do not think for a moment their motives are right. Here's how I know. Because they say Jesus promised the abundant life. He promised it. I got the abundant life. You can have it. He'll give it to my ministry. They know very well that's not the way Jesus' life was. He was not swimming in possessions and luxuries. And for them to define Christianity as something economic and God wanting to make you rich, it's dishonest, it's unbiblical. These guys are crooked. They're really crooked. Do not get sucked in. Yet, many, many members I've talked to, even in our churches, are sucked in. Signs and wonders teaching. Jesus tried to cool it. You never find a revival meeting in the New Testament. Come one, come all, get your miracle, a miracle with your name on it. I believe in miracles. I think God still does miracles today. But Jesus encouraged us not to focus there. Shallow and corny religion, predicting the end of the world, and on and on. So many kinds of crazy things. Visions and dreams teaching. In my newsletter earlier in the year, we went through 12 different systems. But we need to be critics of the church in a good way. Critics. And we'll do better if we prepare our messages well. When we realize that you can't just say what you want to say. You've got to somehow back it up with your life. We've got to care about the needy. When we need to police ourselves, like the prophets of old, all of God's people should be involved in some degree of reflection and feedback. So much I could say about that, huh? Emphasize commonality. We have much in common with postmodern people. We are suspicious of the system, too. We believe in the environment, ecology. That's in the Bible. God cares about the marginalized. Diversity is God's plan. And we're all seeking. None of us has arrived. So you can join me in my journey. I haven't arrived yet. But that sounds so different to this kind of invitation. Come to this high school. We'll have our, you can see our church, and we're not wrong on any subject. If we were wrong on something, I would quit. We've arrived. Years ago, we restored all the truth from the apostolic times. Be with us. I mean, would people even believe you? If they wouldn't be offended, and they'd come and they would see you. They'd see you yawning during a song or something, and I knew it. That's not the gospel message. Come and see these people. For we preach not ourselves, but Christ and as Lord, and we're servants, your servants for his sake, 2 Corinthians 4 says, verse 5. So we emphasize not that we've arrived. On the other hand, we're not saying we don't think this is true. We've experienced it's true, but we're still under construction, okay? You want to join us? Okay, good. And in the old days, that's how we invited people anyway. I actually used to always warn my visitors back in the 70s. Now, when you come to church, not everyone's living like we were looking in the Bible. Just be aware of that. Not everyone's living that way. But no one was expecting that. I mean, who would think I'll find a church where everyone's living the right way? It's a nice idea. Scriptural sensitivity. And so I'm going to close with one kind of analogy here before the final comments. In the Bible, we find black and white. Some things are just so. And other things are not quite as clear. They're gray. Along with this, not all biblical truths are equally important. I mean, what year was Jesus born? Do you know? Are you going to not go to heaven if you don't know the year? Do you know when Pontius Pilate had to leave Israel when he was recalled to Rome? Do you know the year? 36 AD. You didn't know that? I'm concerned for your soul, sister. On the other hand, if I said, you know, Jesus was Jewish, and you go, huh? He was Jewish? It'd be kind of hard to fulfill the scriptures if he wasn't a Jew. So that's a little bit more important than, you know, the exact age. But if you said, yeah, I'm a Christian, but Jesus isn't Lord, no, the $20 bill is my Lord. I make them in my basement and my printing press. I worship money. That's most important to me. Is that guy maybe a Christian? I don't think so. Okay, so there's topography. Some things stick up more than others. Some things are flatter. And it's interesting. But when you flatten everything and say everything's equally important or all sins are equally serious, which is also not true, then you flatten it out and no wonder people aren't motivated to read the scripture because you've made it boring. We emphasize it's a true story. It's rooted in history and geography. That's why every year I take groups to the Holy Land. In 2020, we'll be going to Turkey, where Paul spent most of his ministry. Israel, actually just in a few weeks, and again in the spring. You can learn about that if you're interested in my newsletter. But one of the great benefits of going to the places I read about in the Bible is it reminds me these are real places. It's not just furniture in a fairy tale. Real thing. Here's my partner, Steve Kennard, who we often lead together. Go easy on proof texting. That's some good advice for you. That's when you say, now look at this scripture here. Now, 90 seconds later, now let's turn back to the Old Testament. Okay, now let's go up here to Revelation. Now let's look in Hebrews. Hebrews, it's in the New Testament. It should be in the Old Testament. Yeah, I know. It's what they named it. It's bewildering. Let's learn how to share the scripture without having to flip pages. Because it's amazing how much is right there on the page, and you don't have to go all over the Bible. And when you do, I just say, that looks a little suspicious. Like you're afraid if I read more, I'll find out what you're really doing. Yeah, it does look a little suspicious. And it kind of caters too much to the short attention span of many people in our day. And we just need to trust the word. And so I give the example of John 14. I like this because it's one of the most offensive verses in postmodern thought. When Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, the life. Now, if he said, I'm a way, I'm a truth, then people would have no problem with that. But that's hardly what he says. Now, how do we handle that? Simple. Break it down. He's the way. The way, and I'm not backing off on any Christian doctrine here, but the way is a person. He's the way. A person more than a system. We preach Christ because people are less suspicious of him than they are of you and me and the church. I'm the way. The way was actually one of the terms for the early Christians. Because the Bible is relational. It's not a rule book. It's a book of relationships. But not just relational, also destinational. Right? Like the journey. Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. Truth. He's not saying, I'm the doctrinal truth. So if you're wrong on one doctrine, you don't have me. That's not what he is talking about. The truth ends up being a person. Now, I'm not saying that theology is unimportant. I'm not saying that there aren't true doctrines and false doctrines. But in John 14, it's a person. And that person became flesh. And he's the life. Not my right to live the way I want to, the pursuit of pleasure, the pursuit of happiness. No, but the pursuit of holiness, which helps us learn to love. Postmodern people spend a lot of time in virtual worlds, right? So we need to show them that there is real life in God's world. Faith in Christ works. Taste and see that the Lord is good. So we can do things like that. We can take even the most challenging passages, if we study them properly, we'll say, look, it's about a person. It's about Jesus. It's not about 11 and a half things you've got to change or 10 things you need to believe. It's about Jesus, the Son of God. I think it's time for the church to wake up. Chesterton said, it's not bigotry to be certain we're right. I mean, it could be. But it is bigotry to be unable to imagine how we might possibly have gone wrong. We need to have some humility. We don't claim to know everything. We want to be respectful of truth and keep learning. And yet, postmodernism, it turns out, actually is highly disrespectful because it says we should tolerate any religion except those who think that they're right. Well, do you think you're right, my postmodern friend? Well, of course I do. Oh, you're oppressing me. Okay, a lot more we could say. If you'd like complete notes for a talk on postmodernism, there's several. If you go to my website, search phrase 2SEP17, 2SEP17. And if you'd like that weekly newsletter, Bible study every week, you can sign up right now. Text the word disciple to 66866. There you go. Thank you so much for your attention. I'm going to give up the microphone.